pitworm tore through the hole in reality and went for Kyler. The great worm was tubular, at least 10 feet in diameter, its skin cracked and blackened, fire showing through the gaps. When it lunged, its great bulk heaved forward, and its entire eyeless front opened as it vomited its cone-like mouth. Kylan leapt as each concentric ring snapped out. Each ring was circled with teeth. And when the third ring caught a tree, teeth the size of Kylo's forearm whipped around it into the wood. The pitworm sucked itself forward, its lamprey-like mouth inverting as the rings bit into the wood in turn, shearing a 10-foot section out of the tree trunk before Kylo landed. Instantly, the pitworm lunged again. Again, it went for Kylo. He flipped through the air as the tree the pitworm had cut fell. Kylo grabbed a tree and spun, the Kakari giving him claws enough to sink into the bark and throw him back over the pitworm's back. His sword flashed as he flew over the pitworm, but the blade bounced off the armored skin. There was something white in the corner of Kylo's eye. He dropped to the forest floor and saw it, a tiny white homunculus with wings and a birdmeister's face grinning at Kylo under an enormous nose. It clawed at Kylo's face. Kylo blocked. The homunculus's talons sank smoothly into Kylo's sword. The pitworm lunged again. Its target wasn't Kylo, it was the homunculus. Kylo dropped the sword and flipped once more. He landed on the side of a tree 30 feet up, fingers and toes sinking into the wood. The pitworm slammed into Kylo's sword on the ground, the cone of teeth slapping around the homunculus. Digging deep into the soil as each ring of teeth slapped forward, devouring the white creature and everything around it. The pitworm pulled back, shaking dirt and roots and dead leaves through the air. Satisfied, it began to slide back into whatever hell it had been called from. Then, it shivered. The mountainous mage struck again. By the time Kylo's eyes found the real reason the pitworm had shivered, Lantano Garawashi was halfway through its body. Garawashi's sword moved with Garawashi's speed. In 2 seconds, he had cut through the entire pitworm. And whatever was controlling it yanked it back into hell. Kylo sprang off the tree and landed 10 paces from Lantano Garawashi. Having never fought a pitworm, the Sakurai couldn't have known that they didn't just appear. They had to be called. He let down his guard. The big-nosed Birdmeister acted before Kylo could, stepping out from behind a tree and unleashing a ball of green flame.
Incendus Eternum!
Garawashi brought Kerr Kalestis up, but he wasn't prepared for what happened when that sword came into contact with that magic. Only Kylo was still standing, shielded from the magical explosion by the Kakari covering his skin. The men fell in all directions, but Kura Kalesta stayed in the center of its own storm. It spun once in the air and stuck in the forest floor. Kylo swept Kura Kalesta into his hand. The fallen Birdmeister didn't try to stand. He gathered power, the veer on his arms wriggling in slow motion, their undulations becoming a movement that Kylo could strangely read. The magic would be a gout of flame 3 feet wide and 15 feet long. Before the Birdmeister could release the flame, Kylo ran him through. The Birdmeister's cool blue eyes widened in pain and then widened again in sheer terror as every inky rose thorn tracing of fear in his entire body filled with white light. The veer was gone without a trace, leaving the dead man's skin the normal pasty hue of a northerner. Even the air felt clean. In the distance, to the northwest, A lie cannot command went into a charge. It was far away, within the Dark Hunter's wood.
The bloody fools.
Kyla lured them in, but it was still hard to believe they'd fallen for it. He looked at Kurok.
The things I do for my king.
You're not really gonna throw it away, are you?
I gave my word.
You have the talent and the lifetimes it would take to become that sword's master.
I can't exactly go out in public with a black metal hand, can I?
Wear gloves. Oh, we need to leave, right now. Using magic this close to the wood is like begging the Dark Hunter to come. And there's some kind of magic beacon on the Vordmeister's horse. I chased it away, but it's probably too late.
So that was why Fear hadn't used magic in fighting against the Pitworm. Smart.
You have taken my Kurok.
Did you not take it from someone else?
The gods gave me the blade! Your theft is not honorable!
No, nor, I'm afraid, am I.
Oh, too late. The hunter's coming.
The wolf had told Kyla to stay back 40 paces from the hunter's wood, so Kyla gave it 50. He looked through the lesser trees of the natural forest to the preternatural height and bulk of the sequoias. He felt small, caught up in events vast beyond his comprehension. Kyla hefted Kurok and threw it as far into the wood as he could. It flew like an arrow. As it crossed into the air over the wood, it burned like a star falling to earth. The entire forest began to glow golden. Whatever it was no longer rushing towards him. The three men stood side by side, staring into the wood. Fear thought that he was the only one who was properly terrified. Kyler had distracted the hunter by throwing Kurok into the wood, but there was nothing to stop it from coming back. Kyler calmly folded his legs and sat on the forest floor. The black skin retreated into the young man. He studied the stump where his metallic right hand had been, barely noticing as the wood's autumnal glow deepened to a bloody red and then began to lighten to green. Magic flashed so intensely, Fear's vision went white. Blinking away tears, Fear looked at Kyler. He appeared unchanged. Still half naked, still staring toward the wood, he stood slowly and stretched his arms.
Much better.
He had both arms. He was whole. Lantano Garawashi, now soulless, stared with disbelief. But he wasn't seeing anything except the disappearance of Kur Kalestos. The man who would be king was suddenly Akurin, swordless, an outlaw, an exile, not even to be acknowledged. The cruel pain of implications was beating his future to dust. Lantano Garawashi dropped to his knees.
This path lies before you. Fight Calador and become a great king. This you told me, and I heard only my heart's desire, that I would show those effete nobles in Ainu what their mocking was good for, that I would be Curse King. I did not fight Calador, and now my curse is lost. Thus has Lantano Garawashi reaped death for faithlessness. Night Angel, will you be my second?
A brief look of confusion passed over Kyler. Then his eyes showed recognition. After Garawashi made a lateral cut through his own stomach with a short sword, his second would strike his head from his shoulders to finish the suicide. It was an honor, if a grisly one, and Fear couldn't help but feel slighted.
Fear, Nephilim, messenger from the gods whom I ignored. I would have you serve me another way. Please, carry my story to my warriors and to my family.
A chill went down Fear's spine. Not only would every Sakurai in the world know that Lantano Garawashi had died here, but they would know Kur Kalestos had been thrown into the wood. No matter how Fear told the story, it would be retold until it fit current beliefs. The best swordsman, the best sword, and the deadliest place would be tied together forever in Curren myth. Every new 16-year-old Sakurai who thought he was invincible, in other words, most of them, would head for the Dark Hunter's Wood, determined to recover Kur Kalestus and be Lantano Garawashi reborn. It would mean the death of generations. Kyla's face changed. The mask of judgment was back. Black eyes leaked incandescent blue flame. Studying Lantano Garawashi, he cocked his head to the side. Fear felt a chill at the sight of that visage. Any shred of childhood that had been left in the young man Fear had met 6 months ago was gone. Fear didn't know what had replaced it.
No. There is no taint into the demand's death. Another Koros will come to you, Lantano Garawashi. In 5 years, I will meet you at dawn on Midsummer's Day in the High Hall of the Anu. We shall show the world a duel such as it has never seen. This, I swear.
The Night Angel slapped the thin blade to his back, where it dissolved into his skin. He bowed to Garawashi, and then to Fear, and then he disappeared.
You don't understand.
Garawashi turned wretched eyes to Fear.
Will you be my second?
No.
Very well, faithless servant. I don't need you.
Garawashi drew his short sword, but for once in his life, Fear was quicker than the Sakurai.
Give me a few hours. With 5,000 flies in its web, one more may go unnoticed.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to save you. I'm going to save all your damn stiff-necked, infuriating, magnificent people. I'm probably going to get my damn fool self killed. I'm going to get your sword back.
And then, Fear walked into the wood. The howl woke V. Savare from a dream of Kyler fighting gods and monsters. She sat up instantly, ignoring the aches from another night on rocky ground. The howl was miles away. She shouldn't have been able to hear it through the giant sequoias and the deadening morning mists, but it continued, filled with madness and rage as it flew with incredible speed from the wood's center. Only then did V become aware of Kyler through the ancient Mysterillin gold earring. She'd bonded Kyler as he lay unconscious at the God King's mercy. It had saved Sonaria and Kyler's life, and now V and Kyler could sense each other. Kyler was 2 miles distant, and V could feel that he held something of incredible power. She could feel him reaching a decision. The power departed from him, and he felt an odd sense of victory. Suddenly, it was as if the sun were rising in the south. V stood on shaky knees. 100 paces away, at the enormous sequoias of the Dark Hunter's Wood, the air itself turned a brilliant gold, radiating magic. Even to V, untrained as she was, it felt like the kiss of a midsummer sunset on her skin. Then the color deepened to reddish gold. Every dust mote floating in the air, every water droplet in the mists, was a flaming autumnal glory. Her bones. The sound was moving faster than anything could possibly move. Everywhere it went came the sound of death. There was a battle in the wood. No, a massacre. All the while, the wood pulsed with magic. The flaming red was fading to yellow gold and then to the deep green of vitality. The scent of new grass, fresh flowers.
Kyler has given it new life.
V didn't know how she knew, but she knew Kyler had put something into the wood, and that something was rejuvenating the entire forest. Kyler himself felt invigorated. Well, in a way, he hadn't felt in the week she'd shared the bond with him. Whole. V felt something wrong behind her. Her hands flashed to the daggers at her belt. A ball of blue energy flew through the air where she'd been standing a moment before. Before her, a man wrapped in dark brown leather put his foot on a corpse's face and wrenched a dagger from its eye. The corpse was wearing the robes of a Caladoran Verdmeister, and black, tattoo-like veer were still twitching under the surface of his skin. V's savior cleaned his dagger and turned. But he made no sound. A multitude of cloaks, vests, pocketed shirts, and pouches of all sizes covered the man. All of them horsehide, all tanned the same deep brown, and worn soft from long use. Twin, forward-curving Gurkhas were tucked into the back of his belt. An unstrung scrimshaw shortbow was slung over his back, and V could see numerous hilts protruding from his garments. He unlaced a brown mask that concealed all but his eyes and pulled it back around his shoulders. He had an affable face, wry, almond-shaped brown eyes, loose black hair, and broad, flat features with high cheekbones. He could only be a Yumuri stalker. Stalkers were reputed to be the greatest hunters of all the Yumuri horse lords. They were said to be invisible in the forests or on the grassy steppes in the east where the Yumuri lived. They never shot prey that wasn't running or on the wing, and they were all talented. In other words, they were grassland wet boys. Unlike wet boys, they didn't kill for pay, but for honor. The stalker folded his hands behind his back and bowed.
I am Devar Mahaman Ko Brumezi Wakazari. You may hearken. Call, yes, call me Devi. You are V, yes?
V rose, swallowing. This man had snuck up on her, a wet boy, and thrown her to the ground easily, and now he stood smiling and friendly. It was as unnerving as having a blue ball of death pass inches from her face.
Come. This place is safe no more. I will escort you.
What are you talking about?
Magic calls to, asks to, hearkens to. The demon of the wood beckons. That beckon means death.
That call.
Magic called the hunter. The Verdmeister had used magic and V was talented. The hunter might be coming. The stalker frowned.
These words give me difficulties. Too many meaning.
Where are you taking me? And do I have any choice?
To Chantry. You wish to go?
Yes, please.
Then come. The demon hunts. It's best to leave.
When Dorian had first been studying to become a Hoth Salar, a brother of healing, he'd invented a little weave to mimic the symptoms of influenza by killing the life that inhabited the stomach, with devastating results that cleared up within a day or two. Several times, to Solon's and Fear's vast amusement, Dorian had used it for other than scholarly reasons. Now, influenza swept through the eunuchs, and Halfman was pressed into double shifts and unfamiliar tasks. He'd even made himself sick first to eliminate suspicion. Two of the most trusted eunuchs were sick. Halfman climbed the stairs to the Tiger Tower, an unheated basalt obscenity that looked on the verge of toppling in a high wind. He moved past thousands of the great marsupial cats. They looked like wolves with exaggerated maws, sword-like canines, and orange and black stripes. Everywhere one looked, the tigers looked back. There were tapestries, etchings, tiny statues, ancient mangy stuffed specimens, necklaces of teeth, paintings of tigers tearing apart children. The styles were a hodgepodge, unimportant. All that mattered to Bertold or Sewell was that they featured sword-toothed tigers. Dorian reached the top of the tower, shivering from the cold, sorry that the food he'd carried had long lost its warmth, and apprehensive about who would be up here. If she were one of the talented wives of concubines, she might smell the magic on him. The depth of the woman's ensnarement was such that any who found a traitor would report him immediately. She had long, dark hair, large, dark eyes, a slender but shapely figure under a shapeless dress. No cosmetics heightened her eyes, and none rouged her lips. She wore no jewelry. She smiled, and his heart stopped. He'd never met her, but he knew that smile. He had seen that dimple on the left side, a little deeper than the one on the right.
My lady.
You can speak. They've only sent deaf mutes before. What's your name?
It is death for me to speak, my lady. And yet, how afraid of them are you?
I'm always afraid here. I don't believe I will betray you, but if they torture me, that isn't much to give, is it? I will keep your confidence to the last extremity I can endure. It is a poor and lame vow, but I have been stripped of Richards outside and in.
She smiled then, the same beautiful, sad smile. and he loved her. May the God who saved him have mercy. He couldn't believe it was happening so fast. He'd never believed in instant love. Such a thing could surely only be infatuation or lust, and he couldn't deny that he felt both. But at seeing her, he had an odd feeling of meeting an old friend. His Modaini friend, Antoninus Wervel, said such things happened when those who had known each other in past lives met. Dorian didn't believe that. Perhaps, instead, it was his visions. At Screaming Winds, he'd been in trances for weeks. Though his memory had been mostly scoured of those images, he knew he'd lived lifetimes with this woman in those visions. Perhaps that had primed him for love, for he believed that this was real love, that here was the woman to whom he would yield body and mind and soul and future and hopes unflinching. He would marry her, or no one. She would bear his son, or no one would. It was either that, or the insanity Dorian had feared for so long had finally caught up with him.
They call me Half-Man, but I am Dorian Ursul, first acknowledged son and heir to Garoth Ursul, and long since stricken from the Citadel's records for my betrayal of the God King and his ways.
I don't understand. Why are you here?
For you, Jenny.
You may call me Your Highness, or, as you have evidently come at great risk, you may call me Janine.
Yes, of course, Your Highness.
I think you'd better explain yourself.
Stupid, Dorian, stupid. She's far from home. She's seen her land laid waste by your people. She's isolated, she's scared. And you're not exactly at your best for romance, are you? Ah, hell. She thinks I'm a eunuch.
That was a nice dilemma. How does one interject into a polite conversation?
By the way, in case you're ever interested, I do have a penis. I know it seems implausible, Your Highness, but I've come to help you escape.
Oh, I see. You're a prince, and I'm a princess trapped in a tall tower, and you're here to rescue me. How droll. You can go tell Gareth I got teary-eyed and breathless, and then you can go to hell.
All I need to know, Your Highness, is if you want to leave and risk death, or if you'd rather stay in your comfortable tower until my father, who's old enough to be your grandfather, comes to take your dignity, your maidenhead, and your sanity. You're a little old for my father's preferences, but since you're a princess, I'm sure he'd give you a chance. If you produce a talented son, you'll be allowed to live. You will watch him grow up only from a distance so that your womanly weakness doesn't cripple him. When he's 13 years old, the two of you will be reunited and allowed to spend the next 2 months together. Then my father will surprise both of you by visiting personally and asking what you've taught his seed in the time he's given you. It doesn't matter. What matters is, it will be the first time your son will have a god's undivided attention. At the end of the interview, your son will be asked to kill you. It's a test. Few fail.
You didn't fail it, did you?
The North is a brutal mistress, Your Highness. No one leaves her without scars. I've got a plan, but it won't be ready for 5 days. And everything depends on getting through the pass to Cenaria before the snow flies and the passes close. All I need to know is, if I risk my life to come again, will you leave with me?
She surveyed her prison with clenched teeth. She pulled her high collar aside, and Dorian saw a scar so wide he knew she must have been healed with magic almost immediately. A cutthroat like that would have left her dead in a minute or two.
Back home in Cenaria, I was secretly in love. Logan was a good man, a true friend to my brother, intelligent, and half the women in the city were after him because he was so handsome. The other half were after him because he was heir to a duchy. Logan Geyer would have been a good match for me and for our families, but there was bad blood between our fathers, so I never dared hope my dream might come true. Then an assassin murdered my brother, and my father was left without an heir. He thought that if he made Logan his heir, it would forestall attempts on his own life. So Logan and I were married. 2 hours later, Caladorans murdered my entire family to eliminate the heirs to the throne. But a witch named Nef-Dada thought I was too pretty to throw away. So he cut my throat in front of my husband and healed me afterward. Logan they killed later after subjecting him to God's know-what tortures. These people have taken everything I love. I'll be ready.
Dorian picked up her bread knife. With his talent, he elongated it and gave it two edges while she watched.
There's an Aethling named Tavi. He's fearless while the God King's still in Sonaria. He may come to dishonor you. If he does, my advice is to only use this if you have the perfect opportunity. Otherwise, don't throw away your knife.
The look in her eyes told him if Tavi came, Janine would try to kill him. Failing that, she turned the knife on herself. And yet Dorian gave her the knife, knowing she deserved the choice.
Now, perhaps we can speak of lighter things. Sorry that your food is cold. The hike up the Damsel in Distress's tower is a long one.
You really are a witch, aren't you?
Not now. That magic is evil. I left it long ago and trained with the Magi.
Could you use your magic to bring me warm food?
If I could manage a disguise that convinced Yorba Zurgar I'm a eunuch, I think I can warm your food. Here.
And he warmed her gruel right then, hoping his "I do have a penis" was subtle enough. She cocked an eyebrow at him.
Here I was thinking that if I'd been in an enchanted sleep and my prince needed to awaken me, I'd have been out of luck.
In the books I've read, he wakes her with a kiss.
You've been reading the wrong books.
They spoke for hours. For the next 4 days, Dorian warmed the princess's meals and the princess warmed to him. She was still devastated by the loss of her family and her kingdom and her husband, but his presence gave her hope. He saw the beautiful, sunny girl she had been emerge, and he saw evidence of the decisive, shrewd, charismatic woman she would become. Dorian's respect and love and desire grew for her. They were the happiest days of his life. Kyla's new right arm was still tingling. It looked just like the hand and forearm he'd lost a week ago, except that it bore no scars and was the pallid shade of skin that had never seen the sun. The wolf had thoughtfully given him a swordsman's calluses, but the rest of his skin was highly sensitive. The slightest breath of wind sent waves of sensation. The skin was hairless, but the nails were grown in and perfectly trimmed. The little finger that Kyler had broken as guild rat and that would never fully straighten before was now flawless.
The wolf takes pride in his work. It's better than the hand I lost.
Kyler found his destrier waiting in the woods where he'd left it. The tribe carried him like he weighed nothing, and it ate leagues for breakfast. But though he hated to admit it, the destrier intimidated him. Kyler was no horseman, and they both knew it. This morning, tribe didn't give any trouble as Kyler approached him carefully, absorbing the kakari back into his skin before he came within sight. As usual, Kyler had only worn underclothes beneath the kakari skin. The kakari could go over his clothes, but then the night angel looked lumpy, not exactly fear-inspiring. Tribe stared at him, making Kyler feel strangely self-conscious.
Oh, son of a...
His underclothes had a huge hole right over the crotch. No wonder it was breezy.
Why do you do that?
Do what?
Eat my clothes!
I am the devourer.
You could leave my clothes alone, and my swords.
Some people like short swords.
People like swords with edges.
Good point.
Stop devouring my stuff. Understood?
No, especially not when you ignore my puns.
It wasn't a request.
I understand. I won't obey.
Kyla was stricken silent. He grabbed worsted trousers, tunic, and his spare underclothes from the saddlebag and started to dress. He was stuck with this kakari for how long?
Oh, right. Forever.
You really don't understand this. You, a man of flesh and blood and spirit, could not remain a mild-mannered herbalist for 2 months. But you expect me, a blend of metals and magic artificially infused with some small measure of intelligence and personality, to change my nature. As for the dull swords, I wasn't the one who sold retribution, was I?
Kylo hadn't thought of that. Retribution's blade stayed perfect, despite having been covered with a Kakari for years, and he'd sold it for nothing. No, he'd sold it to show Aline how much she meant to him. The thought of her made him ache all over again. Now he'd fulfilled his vow to the wolf. Now, finally, he could find Aline and make things right. Or at least, more right. He reached up and touched the seamless earring in his left ear that chained him to V. Savari, who now was only miles away, heading east and north toward Forglund's Pass.
Why is V going to the Chantry?
Kyla pushed it out of his mind. That bitch was the last thing he wanted to think about.
A small measure of intelligence and personality, eh?
Fuck you!
Besides, I have changed.
I believe you.
Kyla spun, slashing. Oh. The man was tall like a hero of legend, his armor enameled white plate with a polished mail cloth that flowed around his shoulders in a cascade of steel. His helmet was tucked under his arm, and his face was gaunt, blue eyes bright. Kyla stopped the blade mere inches from Logan Geyer's neck. Logan smiled. Kyla faltered. Abruptly, he sheathed his sword and dropped to a knee.
Your Majesty,
stand up and hug me, you little puke.
Kylo hugged him and saw Logan's bodyguards, half a dozen of Agon's scruffy dogs, led by a beautiful woman with, of all things, a shiny garter on her arm. They were all staring at him suspiciously. Kylo upbraided himself for letting no less than 8 people get so close before he noticed them. He was slipping. But then Kyla let his self-recriminations go as he felt his friend's embrace. Logan's months in the hole had left too many sharp planes on his face and body for him to be handsome again yet, and feeling his slimness as he hugged Kyla was alarming. But there was an aura of rallying strength about him. Logan still had the same broad shoulders, the same noble carriage, and the same ridiculous height.
You're calling me little? I probably outweigh you now. Smallest ogre I've ever seen.
You look good, too. Except, have you been sunning with one glove on?
Logan waved a hand absently. The bodyguards withdrew.
I hacked the old arm off. Had to get a new one.
Another story you're not going to tell me?
You wouldn't believe me if I did.
Try me.
I just did.
What is it with you and the lies?
You want to know why I lied to you for 10 years?
You were spying on me. I thought you were my friend.
You pampered little fuck. When you were worrying about being embarrassed by the nude statue in the entry of your mansion, I was sleeping in sewers, literally, because that's the only way a guild rat can stay warm enough on a freezing night to stay alive. When you were worrying about acne, I was worrying about the rapist who ran my guild and wanted to kill me. So, yes, I apprenticed to a wet boy to get out. Yes, I lied to you. Yes, if you'd ever done anything wrong, I'd have told the Sakaar gang. I didn't like it, but I did it. But let me ask you this, you self-righteous bastard. When you were in the hole and it was kill or be killed, what did you do? I lived in a hole my whole fucking life, and you tell me who's more responsible for what Sanaria has become. My father, who was too weak to raise a child, or yours, who was too weak to become a king?
To take the throne. My father would have had to murder the children of the woman he loved.
And how many children died because he didn't? That's the burden of leadership. Making the choice when none of the choices are good. When you nobles won't pay, others have to. People like me. Kids with nothing.
This isn't about my father, is it?
Where the fuck is your crown?
Did you ever meet Janine Gunder?
When would I meet a princess?
You'd think I'd be over it. Honestly, I'd always assumed that a girl as beautiful and as happy as she was had to be stupid. What an asshole I was. Kyla, have you ever looked into a woman's eyes and found that she made you want to be strong and good and true? Protective, fierce, noble. Finding Janine was finding something better than I ever dared to dream.
Kyla didn't want to hear it. It reminded him of Aline, and if he thought about Aline, his anger would die.
I was supposed to go from that to Terra Grayson? I couldn't. Not for a crown, not for anything.
But I saw everyone on the battlefield bowing to you.
I'd given my troth.
Oh, come on!
I did what I thought was right.
Kyla looked at Logan as he hadn't looked at him even when he'd rescued him from the hole. Then he had only been able to see the physical wounds. Now he saw more. There was the gravitas of pain deep in Logan's eyes.
You do it again.
I'm already having my doubts.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. But yes, I do it again. This is who I am.
Logan had never been more royal.
Let me see him.
Kylo put his hand on his friend's arm and saw Logan, through his own eyes, less handsome but fierce, primal in the filth of the hole, tearing raw flesh from a human leg with his teeth, weeping. There he was, hating the holers, sinking into the filth, becoming a holer in his own eyes. There he was, deciding over the hard knot of hunger that gnawed him day and night, that he would share his next meal, lest he abandon being human altogether. There he was, handing out food and hating those who accepted, but doing it. That small core of nobility became the most important possession Logan had, and he would pay any price for it. That lesson was bound up with Sarah Drake, who had been Logan's fiancée before King Gunder forced him to marry Princess Janine. Logan had loved Sarah once, but that love had withered over the years, finally propped up only by false kindness. He'd been planning to marry the wrong woman because he didn't want to hurt her feelings. Breaking his engagement had been the right thing to do, but it had seemed too cruel. But if they hadn't been engaged, Sarah wouldn't have been at the castle the night of the coup. She'd still be alive. In the hole, sharing food had been the right thing to do. It had seemed stupid, but in the end, the holers helped Logan because he helped them first. Logan's failure and his success had driven home the same lesson.
Do what you know is right, and you'll get the best consequences in the end.
It was, Kylo thought, why Logan might be great. You could count on him. He was loyal, he was honest, and he would fight to the death to do the right thing. Always.
We've both come pretty far. You think we can be friends?
No. Not friends. Best friends.
Then he grinned, and the last years seemed to roll off Kylo's back. They were the kind of friends who would stand and be counted. For Kyler, who had always kept dirty secrets that threatened everything, the feeling was precious beyond words.
What happens now?
One more errand and then, well, I'm going to write a book.
No offense, your ogreishness, but what are you going to write a book about?
You know how I've always loved words. I'm going to write a book of words.
I was under the impression that that's what most books are.
No, no, not composed of words. I'm going to write a book defining all the words in our language. I'm calling it a dictionary.
You're writing it in Geron?
Yes.
Defining Geron words?
Right.
So you'll have to already know Geron to read it.
You make it sound stupid.
How about that?
The idea of Logan's commanding form sequestered in a candlelit study, squinting at manuscripts, was funny. Except that Logan thought he was serious. Logan was scholarly, but he was no scholar. He was born to lead. This book idea was a pretense to shield him from seeing Terra's mistakes and from his own impulses to do something about them. Minutes ago, Kyler had thought he was done. He'd kept his oath to the wolf. He thought that now he'd be free to go make things right with Aline. But now, Terra Grayson was queen. She probably had a contract out on Logan already. The best way to cancel a contract was to cancel the contract taker. And Terra Grayson deserved canceling.
One more kill, and I can change a country. If Logan is king, things can be different. There won't have to be guilds or guild rats anymore.
Aline was still safe in Waedron. He could do this in a week and be on his way.
What army?
What do you mean, what army? You have that look in your eye.
Those Calidorans aren't Calidorans. The Lycanot have been wiped out, and we need to get to Snarri before the Koran army does.
The Koran what? What?
Dorian sat in the chute room, balancing the craft pot strapped to his back on the edge of one of the chutes. This was the last pot of the day, and Dorian was sore, exhausted, and grumpy. And he got to spend most of every day in the company of beautiful women. The chute room slave spent every day in this foul room, directing the slaves who brought in all of the Citadel's human waste and maintaining the sewage chutes. And he was the happiest slave Dorian had ever met. Dorian still gagged every time he opened the door. How the hell could Tabi be chipper? Aching, Dorian stretched his back as he waited for Tabi to finish with the slave from the guards' quarters. Tabi pulled two levers, waited for a few moments, and then pulled a chain. Then the man untied the top rope on his pack, and Tabi tipped the pot over, sloshing the contents down the chute. After he finished, Tabi walked over to Dorian.
This is your last run?
Yes.
He lost his balance, and the weight of the crab pot yanked him back toward the open maw of a chute. Tabi threw himself against Dorian's knees. For several moments, it was agony as the weight of the pot pulled against the sinews of his legs and stomach, trying to pull him into oblivion or rip him in half. But as the open-topped pot released its contents down the chute, the pain faded. Once the pot was empty, Tabi was able to help Dorian out of the chute.
Trying to follow your predecessor, huh?
What?
Why do you figure they needed another eunuch? Last harem carrier did what you just did. Only I wasn't so fast that day.
Shit.
Funny thing is, he didn't die from the ride. They killed him.
What do you mean? Where does this chute go anyway?
Where does this shit go anyway? Down to the mines. Nearly drops on the heads of them sorry bastards. Soon as Ari fell in the chute, I routed him to one of the safe ones. Would have saved his life if he had sense.
Safe ones?
You don't know shit, do you?
Tabi punched Dorian in the arm.
Good one, eh?
Funny.
I didn't see that one coming, did you?
No, didn't see that coming.
Oh, I got a million of them.
I bet.
If there ever was a man who deserved his slavery, I've met him.
Why are some chutes safe?
These chutes here hundreds of years. First, there was only one chute. At first, it was a couple hundred foot drop from the bottom of the chute to the bottom of the chasm. Well, after a couple hundred years with 20,000 folk shooting shit down it, there was no drop at all. Good old Batty Berthold got real nervous. Thought an army of the pit slaves themselves might climb up the chute and attack the citadel from within. So he built this. Now, when this shit gets within 50 feet of the bottom of the chute, we switch to a new chute. We let that first one sit till it's all soil. Then the pit slaves cart it up, and the guards sell it for fertilizer. Course, I got to use all the chutes at least once a day so they don't rust up, and so the pit slaves can tell where the soil is firm under a few inches of crap, and where the soup is deep enough to drown in. When Ari went down, I switched up the chutes so he'd have a chance.
How fast can you do that?
No.
Tabi pulled the third and the eighth lever and pulled the last chain. It took him about 3 seconds. Dorian fixed the positions in his mind.
What happened to him?
He gave some shit to one of the meisters down there. Can't say I blame him after what he'd been through.
Sounds like he had a shitty day.
Two meisters guard the pit slaves. It don't make them happy. They don't take no shit. They turned Ari inside out.
Tabi shook his head, somber. A moment later, he grinned.
They don't take no shit, huh?
I could take two meisters.
When Dorian returned from emptying the crap pots, the concubines were in an uproar. Dorian had never heard anything like it. He set the crap pot down and stared at Hopper.
It's the God King. We just got news. He's dead.
Dorian's heart stopped.
My father's dead.
He wandered into the great room of the harem in a daze. Nearly 200 women were gathered in the cold marble luxury of the place. They were tearing their clothes, ripping out their hair, beating their naked breasts, scratching bloody furrows in alabaster skin. Black tears rolled from their cold eyes. Some had flung themselves on the floor, weeping uncontrollably. Others had fainted. In grief, as in love and in drink, Dorian's people were extravagant. But these women's tears were not for show. They had all lived in awe and terror of the God King, and few of them would have dared love him. None of his favorite concubines were here. No one would report who had wept and who had not. But His Holiness had been the center around which their lives revolved. Without that center, everything collapsed. They would be compelled to throw themselves on Gareth's pyre, to accompany him into the afterlife and be his slaves forever. And Gareth had always liked his women young. The other implications of Gareth's death pounded Dorian a moment later. The God King had left no clear heir, and whichever Aethling succeeded him would certainly kill off the others. If the concubines knew of Gareth's death, the Aethlings would soon, if they didn't already.
Janine!
Dorian burst into the eunuch's room where he'd left Hopper.
Get them all out of here! Start with the virgins!
What?
Hide them in my room! At least one of the Aethlings will try to seize the God King's harem as a declaration that he should be the next God King. Or the guards may go crazy. You can't hide all of them. But at least the virgins will have a chance to be claimed by the next God King. If they get raped, they'll die with the others.
Darn.
Dorian ran up the Tiger Tower. The dreads guarding at the base of the tower were gone, and his heart dropped. He sprinted up the steps three at a time.
All right.
The latch had been melted off the door. The fucker. It was Tavi, come to violate Janine. Dorian kicked open the door just in time to see Janine pull out the dagger he'd given her and bury it in a young man's chest. His gear rose to the surface of his skin instantaneously. A white ball the size of a fist slammed into Janine's chest. Tavi didn't have time to move before Dorian's flame missiles hit him. It wasn't Tavi. It was Rivik, Tavi's sidekick. Dorian went to Janine. She lay, her chest concave with six broken ribs. Dorian put his hand on her chest, seeing the damage. And in moments, Dorian was done.
You came!
I'll always come for you.
I feel perfect!
He allowed himself a smile, but things were not going according to plan. Damn it, everything was ready for tomorrow. The worst of it wasn't the wasted preparations, the lack of horses, the lack of warm clothing for the perilous crossing through screaming winds, the lack of dried food. It was that Dorian had used southern magic. Any Meister who smelled him would sense it. Luxbridge might drop him into the chasm. The chaos in the castle might not help them. More soldiers and Meisters would surely be running about, and more Aethlings definitely would. It meant that all Dorian's meticulous memorization of guards, watch routes, and personal habits was for nothing. Still, he was here. The armies of the God King were not, nor were any of the God King's older sons. Janine was alive and safe, and the passes south were still open. In his wrath, he had vented far too much magic on Rivik, but he still had some left. Enough to take care of a Meister or even a Wurdmeister if caught unawares.
What are you doing?
Janine turned Rivik's body over. He didn't want her to have to look at that.
I can't go like this. I'm taking his clothes.
Together they stripped Rivik. There was blood on the front of the tunic where Janine had stabbed his chest, and six small burn holes on both front and back. But otherwise the tunic was fine. Rivik had been a slight youth, so the tunic was only a little big. Janine threw off her blouse and pulled on the dead youth's tunic, not asking Dorian to look away or turn his back. He stared at her slack-jawed, frozen, then looked away, embarrassed, then wondered why he was embarrassed and she was not, and looked again and looked away. He was twice her age. She was beautiful. She was brazen. She was being perfectly sensible. They didn't have time to be coy.
Hand me the trousers, would you?
The color in her cheeks told him it was a bluff. So he matched brazenness for brazenness and watched her as she pulled off her skirt. She snatched the trousers from his hands.
If you don't watch it, half man, you're going to be considerably more than half a...
Then her eyes went past Dorian to the body behind him. Her jest died, and her high color drained away.
Let's get out of here. I hate this place. I hate this whole country.
Janine finished dressing in silence and pulled on the fluffy hat Dorian had frequently worn to cover his own face as much as possible, piling her long hair on top of her head in a bundle. In the end, it was a poor disguise, not because of the clothes, but because Janine didn't walk like a man and couldn't learn in the few moments Dorian was willing to spare trying to teach her. But if she didn't look like a man, she didn't look like a princess either. They'd just have to hope everyone was distracted.
Oh.
Fear had asked for 2 hours to get Lantano Garawashi's sword out of Ezra's wood. He had no idea how much of that time had passed. In fact, he couldn't remember how he'd come here. He looked up at the towering sequoias stretching to the sky. Well, at least he knew where he was. He was definitely in Ezra's wood. He looked at his hands. Both of them were scraped and his knees hurt as if he'd fallen. He touched his nose and could tell it had been broken and then set properly. There was still crusty dried blood on his upper lip. Dorian had told him stories about men who'd taken a blow to the head and forgot themselves, either forgetting everything before the blow or, more commonly, completely losing the ability to remember anything at all after the blow. For several moments, Fear felt a panic rising inside him at the very thought. But aside from his nose, his head didn't feel as if he'd taken a blow. He could remember leaving Lantano Garawashi. He could remember approaching the vast bubble of magics that surrounded Ezra's wood, and he could remember the turmoil within those magics as, miles to the east, the Lycanaut had entered the wood and been trapped within it. Fear had used that turmoil as a distraction for his own attempt, but from that point, he could remember nothing. He was facing the bubble now as if he was leaving. He took a few more steps, disoriented, and came around the trunk of another giant sequoia. Before him, not 50 paces away, just outside the magic, were Lantano Garawashi and, oddly, Antoninus Wervel.
Well, maybe I've gone mad.
Antoninus Wervel was a red mage, one of the most powerful and most intelligent men to walk the halls of Shokendi in decades. He was a fat Modaini man, and he'd been a casual friend for years. To see him sitting awkwardly cross-legged behind Lantano Garawashi, who sat as gracefully as he did everything, was surreal. Then the men saw Fear and both rose. Antoninus called something out, but though he was only 40 paces away now, Fear couldn't hear him. Fear walked straight to the wall of magic. Whatever clever magic he'd used to get into the wood, it obviously hadn't been clever enough. He was alive only by the forbearance of whatever it was that lived here. So Fear walked straight through the magic. It slid around him, and for a moment, he could swear something in the wood felt amused. Then he was out.
What are you doing here?
You escaped the wood, something no mage has done in 7 centuries, and you ask what I'm doing?
Do you have my sword?
Fear was carrying a pack strapped to his back that he hadn't been carrying when he entered the wood.
Him first.
I came with a delegation from Shokendi to recover Korak. After the Battle of Pavel's Grove, the delegation turned back. They were certain that if Korak had been present in such a desperate battle with so many magi and meisters present, that someone would have tried to use it. No one did. So they decided to backtrack and follow other leads. The truth is, I don't think Lord Lucius trusts everyone in our delegation. He and I don't care for each other. But he knows where my loyalties lie, so he released me. So, now it's your turn, Fear. Did you recover Kur Kalestos?
The Modaini was too damn smart. Fear could tell that the man had put together Fear, who'd held one nearly mythical sword, with the appearance of another nearly mythical sword and found no coincidence. Fear opened the pack. There was a note inside with directions and instructions, written awkwardly, as if the hand writing it had been writing in an unfamiliar language. Fear read it quickly and remembered bits and pieces of what had happened in the wood. Setting the note aside, he pulled a hilt out of his pack. A hilt only, with no sword. It was a perfect replica of the one on Kur Kalestos, and it would fit Lantano Garawashi's sheath perfectly. As long as the Sakurai didn't draw his sword, no one would ever know.
What is this?
It's 3 months.
What?
That's the time I need. I'm a maker, Garawashi, and I received instructions in the wood, a prophecy left by Ezra himself centuries ago. If you prefer death, I will be your second. But if you want to live, take this hilt. Antoninus and I will go to Black Barrow and do things no one has done since Ezra's time. I will make Kur Kalestos for you by spring. You can be the king you've always wished to be.
Lantano Garawashi stood for a long moment, eyes hot and then cold, trapped between his desires and his honor.
You swear you will bring me my kudos?
I swear it.
Lantano Garawashi took the hilt. Logan and Kyler rode at the head of Logan's column of 500 horsemen and 900 footmen. Logan's bodyguards rode 10 paces back, giving them privacy. The sharpened-toothed simpleton Nasher rode in his usual spot beside Logan, but he didn't care what they might say. He just liked to be close. Kyler unrolled a worn letter.
What you got?
Kyler gave him an inscrutable look, shrugged, and handed it to him.
Hey, I thought it was my last one, too. He said I got one more for old time's sake. He might even have been telling the truth. Be careful who you love. Don't follow prophecies. Don't let them use you to bring the High King. Your secret is your most important possession. You're more important than I ever was, kid. Maybe for all those years I was just holding it for you. Make no deals with the wolf.
I assume this all means something to you?
Not all of it.
Who's the wolf?
Someone I made a deal with right before I found that letter.
Ouch. And the High King?
That was the part I was hoping you could help me with.
Well, there was a High King who held Cenaria and several other countries maybe 400 years ago, but Cenaria's been held by lots of different countries in the last 1,000 years. Sounds like an Ursul thing. They're the only ones in Mid-Kiru in a position to rule over other kings. I guess they're dredging up a prophecy to give themselves legitimacy. Is the secret what I think it is?
Here we are.
They had circled Ezra's wood, looking for signs of the Lycanaut. Kyler said it was something Logan needed to see for himself. 50 paces away, Logan saw a wall of dead men. Hundreds of them pressed against an invisible barrier, trying to escape the forest. In places, bodies were piled 20 feet deep as men had clambered over the dead, hoping to reach the top of the invisible wall. There was no movement. No one was merely injured. Everybody had been mangled, torn with sharp claws that must have had godlike strength. Helmets had been crushed flat, heads were simply missing, swords had been snapped like twigs, even the horses were dead, heads torn off, sinews ripped through the skin, some muscles snapped instead of torn. For as far as the eye could see into the Sequoias, there was only devastation. And as far as the eye could see west and east, Lycanaut were pressed against an invisible wall. They tested every place they could before dying and found it everywhere impregnable. Gore still drained from the bodies, gliding against the wall like glass. But strangely, there was no smell. The magic sealed in even the air.
The villagers of Taurus Bend say someone tries to go into the wood every generation. It happens so much that their term for suicide is walking into the wood.
Logan turned. Kyler's eyes were hollow. Stricken.
I did this. I lured them here so they'd fall into the Kurin's trap instead of you. These souls are on my tab.
Our scouts heard the fighting. That's why we held back. What you did here saved 1,400 lives.
At the cost of 5,000.
And maybe saved Cenaria.
It wasn't making a dent.
Captain, bring the men forward in groups. I want everyone to see this. I don't want any Cenarian to ever make the mistake we almost did.
Caldrosa Wynn saluted, obviously glad to be given a duty to take her away from the massacre.
Kyler, I know you think you're a bad man, but I've never seen anyone who will go to the lengths you will to do what you've decided is right. You are an amazingly moral man, and I trust you, and you're my best friend.
Logan looked steadily at Kyler to let him read the truth. Kyler gave a sarcastic, "You can't be serious," grimace that slowly melted. The tension left his face as the truth sank in. Logan meant every word. Kyler blinked suddenly, once, twice, and then looked away.
Oh, my friend, what have you gone through that being called moral nearly makes you weep? Or was it being called friend?
Logan had been isolated for months in the hole and found it hell. Kyler had been isolated for his entire life.
But?
Not stupid either, are you?
Kyler flashed that old mischievous grin, and Logan loved him fiercely.
But you were a wet boy, Kyler. And now you're something even more dangerous. I can't claim that I know what you might do to Terra.
Do you really trust me?
Yes.
Then this conversation is finished.